Talo Falava, I'm Sosef Womoli. Join me for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent mixed with the sounds and vibe our Islander audiences love by artists from across the seas as well. Search up ABC Sister Sounds to listen online or find it in the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
This is Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia.
Our guest today is a storyteller who proves that the most profound wisdom is often found in a joke. He is a celebrated artist who has taken his work from the queer bars of Sydney to the prestigious Biennale, all while championing the misfits, the hard workers, and anyone who has ever felt out of place in a theatre. He is a master of the Samoan clown, a former nutritional medicine student who followed a literal dream to the stage, and a creator who creates work that is as fiercely funny as it is deeply moving. He is here to talk about finding home, the power of satire, and why the best art is always about connection. Please welcome the brilliant Tommy Missa.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
You spent your early years in Samoa before your family relocated to Canberra. What is one distinct quality or lesson you feel you got from each of those two homes?
I would say, okay, so for Samoa, because when I think about what felt like a big thing that I left behind was being outside. And I think there's so much that happens in Samoa outdoors, and the architecture, like homes in Samoa, are open. So there isn't this a separation between the outdoors and the indoors. So I think that's a big quality that I often forget here. I live now in Gadigal country in Sydney, is to be outdoors as much as I can, and how important that is to touch the grass, for real.
Quite literally.
Quite literally. And then in Canberra, slowing down, every time I go back to Canberra, also every time I go back to Samoa, but every time I come back to Canberra, it's always the pace. It's like dropping into the pace. Last year when I was there, I went back for 4 months and I was hanging out with a lot of old school friends who, I don't have children of my own, but most of my friends back home have kids. And the Saturday that I was hanging out at one of my friends' houses was one of the kids' birthdays, and we spent the entire day at the kids' party. And I'm just so not used to that in Sydney, where it's like in Sydney on a Saturday, you've got your kid's birthday and then you're running across town on your Lime bike and you're going to somebody's 25th birthday and then somebody's 50th and then you're going to head to club and then you're going to dance until the sun rises. So
you're right.
Slowing down, you know, so luxurious to spend time with people down there and that to be the only thing on the day, to just move slow, eat slow, talk slow, you know?
Yeah. In a large Pacific Islander family, there are often expectations. Was there a specific family path you were expected to follow in your family?
I don't think there was any expectation to follow a certain path. Mm-hmm. I am one of six boys and we were brought up in different households. And I don't think that we've ever been expected to follow a certain path. I think my parents were very keen for us to be happy. And I would say, though, that like I have felt like maybe it's as the queer person of the family that my role has been in some ways to be of service to the family or to the village, like what my village looks like. You know, I live in a different city to most of my family, so I think my role that I've fallen into is of being of service in different ways, and I guess in a big way it's in storytelling to yeah, to be of service to the story and who that is telling the story about and for.
Yeah, beautiful. Now, another interesting fact about yourself is that you were homeschooled by your mum for a period of time there. How did your mother's approach to education shape the way you learned or saw the world?
Oh, that is a great question. And shout out to my mum, Helen Misak, because she is an incredible teacher. She's a teacher's assistant now. But when we were homeschooling, because we'd come back from Samoa and the schooling system in Australia is very different. And when we came back and my parents and my mum wanted us to have an education that was outside of the classroom. So I think part of our education was like also was cooking and like housework. And that was all kind of built into the day of, you know, like one of us would have a turn cooking, and that would be maybe the afternoon task for the school day. It would be like cooking something new, or she would teach us how to cook something, or we'd go on so many excursions. Like she would just find ways to take us out into the world and experience the world. You know, if it was just going to like our local park and picking leaves and like coming home with a bunch of leaves and making something out of them. And I think that in particular, that way of being really resourceful and not having, you know, the money to take us to whatever big excursion, you know, like I would speak to people at church and they were going on their school camps and they were going to the snow, or I wasn't going to the snow. You know, we were going and doing things in our area and like exploring our community, or like going down to the local nursing home and singing. Like we would do that often, go to a nursing home called Miranjani in Canberra, and we would sing with other like church homeschool kids, and then we'd hang out, and I would always love to hang out and raid the Bicky table.
And shout out to your mum. I mean, I don't know. I am a mum myself. I don't know if I'd be able to homeschool like my own child or children. It's quite, you know, teachers have a hard job.
Such a hard job.
And you often create work for the misfits and the hard workers. How did the experience of growing up as a misfit yourself influence the kind of stories you tell today as an artist?
I have this memory of first entering into the arts industry, and it was going to a show at a main stage theatre company, and it was about a working class Australian family. It was a white family, but it was meant to be representative of the hard workers and of the struggle and the brilliance of hardworking Australian families. And I have this really clear memory of going to it with someone that I was seeing at the time and not really understanding anything that was going on, because the style of the show and the writing of the show was very cerebral, and it was like for an academic audience. And I walked out of it, and afterwards there was a bunch of people and we were all standing around and everyone was talking about what they got out of the show. And then someone turned to me and asked me what I got out of it. And I froze and I didn't know what to say, because I didn't really understand what the play was about.
Oh, wow.
And that, I just think about that a lot because that I think has been a really big part of informing my practice and way of storytelling. And as I upskill in my own writing style and my own understanding of how to write and how to create in a way that I guess is informed by like being in the main sort of theatre world, I still try to come back and return to this thing of being like, how would I feel when I first entered the industry? If I came into this show, would I understand what's going on? Would I relate to the language? How are the characters speaking with each other? And can I connect to that way, that style of speech, or those stories? So, I think that I always think about like how is someone feeling that I'm telling a story about when they come into the show, first and foremost.
And your work is also rooted in Samoan humour. I'm wondering, what were your sort of early influences at home or in your community that taught you your specific sense of humour?
My dad was a big one. He's since passed now, but yeah, his way of finding the humour in in any light, you know, in the darkness, and sometimes finding the humor in the darkest places was his absolute gift, that I aspire to be like that. Growing up, you know, like I think of like laughing with someone's, like the comedy duo feels really like, I just remember sitting around with the family and watching that and just finding it so sort of funny that, again, like going back to this idea of resourcefulness and finding, you know, like, because they would do these shows and it would just be the two of them sitting on the stage, and they might have like a lava, you know, like a Samoan sarong, and they would do a million different things with this lava, or they would, you know, it would become the set and it would become a headpiece and it would become all of these different things. And I think, yeah, like the resourcefulness of Pacific humor in just finding the humor in like anything. Recently I was watching some old archive footage of the Miss Samoan Fafafinga pageant that has been running now for, I think it's been running for 40 years.
Wow.
It's been running for a really long time. And I was watching some footage from the pageant from the 90s and just watching these Fafafinga people perform and make these incredible costumes out of whatever they had. And also, yeah, again, like the resourcefulness of like making props out of whatever was around, you know, and it was usually just things growing in the garden.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's one thing our people are good at, it's being resourceful, working with what we have.
Working with what we have, yeah, and making it incredible and so beautiful.
So beautiful. Now, you've mentioned before that your call to performance came to you in a dream. Can you tell us what that dream was and how it made your career path suddenly feel clear?
Yeah. So I had just started a degree studying nutritional medicine, and I was coming up to the census date where it was about to, you know, if I didn't pull out, then it would go on to HECS and I would have to pay for that semester. And I was kind of stressing about it because I was like, I don't want to have a HECS date if I'm not going to do this degree. And then this one night, it was actually like maybe 2 or 3 days before the cutoff date, I had this dream, and in this dream I was with, long story short, for many years I had a visitor that would come to me most nights, and I didn't know for many years who that visitor was. It was always like a known presence, as in I knew that that was a friendly energy, a friendly spirit, but I didn't know who it was and what it was and why it was there. And many years later I figured out that it was a sibling that my mum had lost in a miscarriage. And in this dream, I was on a stage and that energy was there, that spirit was there with me. And I can't even, you know, like I wasn't like at the Roslyn Packer Theatre, like looking out into the stage. I was just like on a very, it was like there was some lights. I knew I was elevated above the audience. And I don't even know what I was performing, like, because at the time I didn't even know what acting was. I just knew that I was on a stage.
Yes.
And that energy was there. My sibling was there. And I just had this like overwhelming feeling of home, of feeling so comfortable and excited and elated. And like that, everything that I fumbled to say in the words in my everyday was like able to come out.
Mm.
Like this, you know, I felt so open and free. Yeah. And I woke up the next day and I messaged my mom and I was like, Mom. And she was so used to me always sending texts being like, Mom, I'm now this. And I sent her the message and I was like, Mom, I want to be an actor.
Oh gosh. Every parent's worst nightmare.
And she was like, okay, darling.
Okay.
No, she was actually really good about it. My mum always said that she thought I could be Oprah Winfrey. She was like, I just think you would be such a good, like, talk show host. And so when I said I wanted to be an actor, she was like, I knew it. I knew it.
I saw it. I saw it in you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and you went on to train at National Institute of Dramatic Art, otherwise known as NIDA, and also at the Atlantic Theatre Company in New York. What was the hardest part about taking that training and making it fit your own style of performance?
With performance, making an intentional career choice, the first stop was acting and doing acting lessons. And before that, as a kid, I used to perform, perform in church, sing in church. And when we were kids, we were in part of a Samoan dance group in Samoa, and we'd go to practice and then we'd go and perform at different cultural events around the city. And so there were, I guess, very different ways of being a performer. One was about community performance, and then the other was about career performance and also very structured performance. And I remember starting acting classes and all of these things that I felt really intuitive around performance and audience and how to connect with an audience. I felt like they were being structured in a way that didn't feel natural to me, like studying a script, which is really important to understand what the story is trying to tell and study the script. But I believe that in my practice, the most important thing is the audience and the connection to the audience. So I found that quite difficult at the beginning because I also didn't know that there were other routes to performance and to being a storyteller as a career that weren't like going to an acting school and weren't learning how to understand a script and dissecting that. And also the hierarchy I found really strange, like the hierarchy of in traditional performance spaces of being like, this is the director and it's the director's say. And also the really separate different departments, you know, you have the lighting and you have the set design, and those are departments that as an actor you don't have any input in that in, you know, those traditional spaces. And or like set, for example, you know, like we don't build the set or we don't have input in the set, but we're the ones interacting with it on the stage every night. And so I found that hard to understand the rules.
Right.
Understanding the rules of engagement. Like if you want to be an actor in this country, these are the rules of engagement and these are the parameters that you can venture in and out of, but try not to venture out of them because, you know, you got to know your place.
What is the Tommy Missa style of performance? If you had to define your creative signature in, let's say, three words, what would that be?
Oh, three words.
Okay, five.
Let's do three words. That's great. That's good. I'll do three words. I would say audience, play, and it's not that serious. I know that's not three. That's a saying. It's not that serious.
It's not that serious.
You know, it's such a privilege to do this job and to get to follow this path.
Yeah.
And it feels really important, I think, to remind myself and acknowledge that I'm so lucky to be able to do this. So lucky and so grateful for it. And it is not that important.
Yeah. Yeah. Take that pressure off yourself. And you've mentioned before that you intentionally sought out mentors from the queer and Pacific art elders in Sydney. What was it about their work, I guess, that gave you the most necessary education?
I think early on, I discovered the work of Emale Ngawule, who's a Bugalawan Fijian maker and storyteller, and I was part of a development program years ago that she was running, and at the same time she was part of Blackbirds and was making really interesting, exciting theatre that I wanted to know how to make. And I really loved her process. I've worked with her a number of times in, all sorts of different projects. Actually, I have a call with her after this for something. But yeah, I think realizing how important it was to learn from people that you look up to and who you resonate with their work. A show that we did, Galanga Atu, at the Art Gallery of New South Wales a few years ago that she was directing, every morning she wanted rehearsals to be in Maroubra next to the water so that every morning we could start the day in the water. So every morning before rehearsals, we would go down to Maroubra and have a swim together, the whole company. But things like that really, I think, taught me the importance of connection. I think there's crossover between Pacifica and queer makers in that idea of connection and community, and kind of prioritizing that in the process of making new work, of being together, and like, you know, how can the story evolve from those morning swims and those moments of connection, or the moments when you sit around and have some kai, have a feed, you know?
Yeah. Your solo work, They Took Me to a Queer Bar, was a huge success. How did that project allow you to explore the intersection of your Pacifica and queer identity on stage?
Well, I think that the journey of the show was sort of loosely based off, actually, why am I saying loosely? It was quite specifically based off my journey of finding this bar, this queer bar, the Bearded Tip, and finding a sense of family and community and a way of being in a space together that, you know, how can we all co-collaborate to create a home together? And I think the, you know, like a big part of Pacific storytelling and of queer performance making is like, you know, you have the text, but then you also like, what's the performance that you're adding to it? Like, when's the lip sync happening, or when's the siva happening, when you're doing the, you know, the Samoan dance, or these sorts of things of like adding in the layers of song and of dance and of, you know, moments to break the tension of the words. And these moments that also can feel really alive with an audience, in to how can you engage with an audience in a performance? And, you know, something that I have taken on from collaborators and mentors like MMA Gibson, Betty Grumble, and Emile is like greeting the audience at the top of the show and interacting with them and saying hello. And kind of breaking down those rules of engagement of being like, I'm the performer and you're the audience, and saying like, hello, we're here to have a conversation, and I'm here to tell a story. And there might be moments where you have to participate to tell the story. Yeah. So I think those kind of ways of being with the audience and interacting with them, for me, I think it can come from many different cultures, but for me, it's been from looking to how queer storytellers and Pacific storytellers are with their audiences.
Yeah, amazing. Let's talk about your other work that's you recently performed, Working Class Clown. And that was a major commission, right, for the Biennale of Sydney. What was the genesis of this project?
Working Class Clown came about, they had first approached me about doing a work and wanted to ask what I would pitch. And the festival was happening in the White Bay Power Station, which was a disused power station in Rozelle in Sydney, which hadn't been used for 40 years, that it had been shut down and had just, yeah, laid dormant, nothing really happening. And I thought that was really interesting, that there was this power station that had never, that hadn't had people in it, but had the stories and the history of all of these working class people, you know, doing physical labor in these spaces. And that sort of inspired the first version of it in some ways, was thinking about that space and thinking about my dad, who inspired the show as well, who was a working class man, and who was always a really hard worker and always found ways to entertain in the workplace. So that, I guess, like, was the start of the work. It then evolved into something really completely different, and sort of more became about some parts of my journey of like being in this city and being in an industry where I often don't feel like there's many other people who will be in the room who understand not being in this industry and not having backup and not having money to support you through it. And so then it kind of, the story then evolved from about being about like this character that I was like, a, you know, it's a part of me called Pepe Toa, which means baby warrior. And Pepe was like existing in this city and interacting with the strangeness of institutes. And then partway through the show, we understand and we get this news that Pepe's father has died. And then the show kind of really switches, and then it becomes about connection and how I can connect and create with the audience. And the set that was this like mound of woven leaves that you don't understand why it's there then becomes a roof. And together with the audience, we build a fale, build a Samoan house, traditional Samoan house. And right at the end, I get some audience members to come on stage and actually physically help me lift the roof. And the roof kind of signifies the grief and the loss and the isolation that you can feel in these kind of big cities, and particularly living in a city where everyone is earning a certain amount of money, feeling really isolated in that. So the final moment was about like, how can we as community, as people, how can we lift each other up?
Mm.
Like in action. So we build this fale and they lift the roof, and then I end up with this beautiful structure on stage at the end.
The show also takes inspiration from the Samoan clown. And for our listeners, would you be able to share with us, I guess, what the function of what is and the function of the Samoan clown, please?
In traditional Samoan sense, a village would have a faleaitu, and a faleaitu, which translates to house of spirits, was someone who was said to be the vessel for spirits to come through, and that they were, you know, like possessed by a spirit, by Aitu, and that gave them the power to then be able to, like a jester does in the, you know, in the English court, gave them the power to be able to bring the issues of the village to the chiefs, to the higher powers. And to present that in a way that was like farce and slapsticky and was, you know, quite absurd. And so then it was, I guess, like a way to kind of break down the barriers of what the problems were within the village and present that to them, and for them to be, for, you know, the chiefs to be able to see themselves in this performance and laugh, you know, laugh at themselves, and then hopefully make some change. So that's like the, I guess, the, you know, pre-colonial, like traditional sense of the faleaitu, of the clown. And now I think that informs Samoan humor. It's often really pushed to the edges of, you know, you go to the edge of the joke and then you go beyond. It's like, this is the funny part, and now I'm going to go the next step, and now I'm going to add something physical to it, and then I'm going to add something vocally that's really strange, and I'm just going to keep going past the edges of absurdity until it then becomes something completely different to like the joke that it was to begin with.
Yeah, and this work is a lot of it is about exploring grief, and I'm wondering, through having performed it, were there any new discoveries or anything new that you learned about grief that you didn't know before?
I learned so much about my own grief through this show. I think what maybe surprised me was learning about other people's grief, and that my story, which was specific to my experience of grief and specific to the way that I lost my father, which was very sudden and was tragic, was that even people who came up to me and spoke to me after the show, who came from a world completely opposite to mine, and who maybe, yeah, came from a different, completely different experience, but their connection to my grief was so similar in the feelings and the ways of feeling. You know, like a long time in the first couple of years after the death of my dad, felt like my version of isolation was like so exclusive to me because of my circumstances and because of the world that I've come from. And then having these interactions with people who may have had a lot of money or may have had the time to be able to grieve with the person that they're losing, and who may have had the experience of being able to like say goodbye over a number of years, which I didn't have to get that experience. But they described to me this feeling of isolation that I felt so seen in, and I felt was so specifically my own. And yeah, I think it really taught me about the unity of grief, and that it is it is this really unifying thing.
Yeah, amazing. Thank you for sharing that. Tommy, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your incredible journey. It's really very inspiring to hear how you have trusted your own creative vision to carve out a space that feels honest, collaborative, and fiercely your own. By championing the Samoan clown, you are demonstrating to us that our traditions are powerful, living tools for modern social commentary. You remind us that the greatest acts of creation often come from finding the heart and humor in our community and turning grief into a force for collective joy. Thank you for the vital, beautiful work you are putting out into the world.
Thank you.